Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. Our first guest says the time to think about climate change is now and outlines a path to creating businesses that can do big things, things like mitigating climate change, paying living wages, and having missions that benefit the common good. Our guest, Melissa Scanlon, is the author of this new book. It's titled Prosperity in the Fossil-Free Economy, Cooperatives and the Design of Sustainable Businesses. She's also the Lined Eline Endowed Chair in Water Policy, Director of the Center for Water Policy, and a professor at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee School of Freshwater Sciences. And she's affiliated faculty at UW-Madison Law School. So as we visit with her about her book, I hope you'll join in with your questions. What questions do you have about cooperatives or sustainable business models? Do you have questions about maybe environmental law in business? Give us a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or you could email us the email address ideas@wpr.org. ideas@wpr.org. Melissa Scanlon, welcome. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Oh, thanks for having me. This is really a huge treat to be on your show. So,
well, it's great to have you here. Maybe tell a bit to start about yourself and what brought you to write this book.
Sure. I've spent the past 20 years working as an environmental lawyer and teaching environmental law and becoming more and more alarmed about the state of our climate and how seeing how much we're losing ground every year in terms of environmental protection. So I came to realize that environmental law, although my specialty, was really not answering was really not the strongest way to reform environmental outcomes. And that brought me to look at business design.
Yeah. And, you know, just to set the stage, maybe you could talk about the current climate situation as we know it and as you write about it in your book.
Sure. It's not a real fun thing to talk about, but it's extremely important for us to talk about. So the international body that is the most respected body on climate science is called the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. And they convene and issue reports on the latest state of science. So in August of this year, they issued their latest report, and it had the starkest statements yet about the major alterations that are already underway in virtually all of our global systems. And their message was that without major changes in human behavior, the future is going to be quite bleak. We have carbon dioxide levels that are at their highest level in over 800,000 years, and they keep rising. Greenhouse gases from human activities are already responsible for an increase in temperatures since 1850 of 1.1 degrees Celsius. Now, I know that sounds really, really small, but this is already resulting in changes. The climate crisis is already here. So look at the summer alone of 2021. We had Hurricane Ida. That would have been enough, right? But we also had the Dixie fires in California, these incredible heat waves across the Pacific Northwest like no one has ever seen. And that's just in the United States. Of course, in Germany, they suffered that extreme flooding. And in China's central Henan province, they had a once in a thousand year storm, 24 inches of rain in 3 days. So this is all happening now with this, what sounds like a relatively small increase in temperatures.
Yeah. Well, and you write in your book about what and maybe who brought us to this situation. And we know, you think we really know why and who got us here.
Yeah, I do write about that. And I also want to emphasize that we can still avoid the worst case scenarios of extreme suffering. And the climate scientists are telling us that if we stop burning fossil fuels and reduce greenhouse gases to zero as soon as possible, that'll make a real difference. There are things that we can't stop, like sea level rise, and it will continue to get hotter, but we can slow that. And action right now is really critical.
So is anybody taking steps to make solutions happen?
Well, I think a lot of people are have been frustrated with the state of government and the ability of government to take steps. And that really was also part of a motivator for me in this book to look to the private sector and see where we could see changes happening already. So I was searching for sustainability pathbreakers in the private sector to see who was out ahead of the law. Yes, we absolutely need laws that will move the economy off of fossil fuels, but there's already a lot happening in the private sector, even without that. And that's what I think is pretty powerful, to look at who's taking the lead and what kind of business structure do they have that allows for that.
Yeah, and you have some great examples in your book. You do spend some time talking about capitalism itself in the book, how it could look and how it actually looks now. How do you see today's version of capitalism?
Well, I think capitalism is not necessarily counter to addressing climate change. The sustainability leaders I feature in the book exist in capitalist economies. However, we need to reimagine capitalism so it serves humanity instead of the other way around. And the starting point for that reimagining is looking really carefully at the dominant business model in capitalism, which is the investor-owned corporation. They do really, really well what they're designed to do. Their top priority is producing financial returns for shareholders without any real commitment to larger goals. And so you can see incredible growth in the stock market and in GDP. And at the same time, you can see that they are externalizing environmental costs, and we have rising greenhouse gases. You can see the wealth gap growing in many, many societies. I mean, just looking at the United States, Thomas Piketty's work gave us the ability to see how this system generates income inequality. And since the mid-1970s, the top 10% of Americans kept increasing their share of income, so that by 2007, they held 50% of all the income. And that's because the benefits of GDP growth and stock market value disproportionately go to those who invest rather than those who rely on their labors to earn money. So what I'm talking about in the book is the need to rethink and redesign the dominant business enterprise if we're going to have a livable planet with greater shared prosperity. And what better time to do that than one where we are trying to transform ourselves to move off of fossil fuels?
Oh, man. Our guest today, Melissa Scanlon, her book is Prosperity in the Fossil-Free Economy, the subtitle Cooperatives and the Design of Sustainable Businesses. We'll certainly talk about cooperatives with her as we move along. But I want to give Jack in Milwaukee a chance to join in. Jack, hi. Thanks Hello. For calling.
Am I on the air?
Yes.
Yeah, a fairly simple issue, but one of the problems I've encountered is that from a regulatory standpoint, our government often, it appears, allows companies to self-certify that what they're doing is correct, most notably Volkswagen, where we had this terrible problem with air pollution. Mm-hmm. And I'm just kind of wondering here, because looking further at that issue, every couple of years you have to have your car emission tested here in Wisconsin along the lakeshore.
Yeah.
And what I saw was, if I went back and I looked at the Code of Federal Regulations back in 2001, they had a problem that certain elements of their pollution control system on the cars did not work reliably. So they gave a waiver back door to the industry to allow portions of it not to function. The upshot is where are we?
Yeah. Okay. And you certainly address this whole regulatory portion in your book. Talk about that.
I appreciate the question, because I think what you're really identifying is how this investor-owned corporation like Volkswagen prioritizes returns to shareholders to the point that they're willing to cheat on emissions, right? And that's really the nub of the problem, and why I think cooperatives offer a really good alternative, because they are a values-based business model, and one that uses multiple values to define sustainability. And what I mean by sustainability, sometimes you hear about triple bottom line businesses.
Yeah.
What that means is that the business is oriented towards producing returns that are not just financial, but financial, social, and environmental, and has an auditing system in place to show that they're producing those triple bottom line returns. So that is really what leads into thinking about cooperatives as a democratic enterprise that can produce that kind of sustainable triple bottom line return.
Thank you very much, Jack, for that question. Appreciate it very much. I was thinking, as you were talking, I was thinking about back in my undergraduate days, which is a while back now. I took a course in cooperatives, and at the time, thereabouts, every person who wanted to be a teacher in Wisconsin had to take a course in cooperatives and how they function. I don't think that's the case anymore.
Wow, that's incredible to learn about that history. May I ask what university offered that?
UW-Madison. I have my bachelor's here and master's and PhD, for that matter. But Marv Scharz taught it, and taught through the College of Ag and Life Sciences, and every teacher, regardless of what department they were in, had to come and take a course on how cooperatives function. And I always thought that was a really valuable tool, and we got away from that.
That is fascinating. So in the book, I highlight case studies from the United States, but also from Spain, because they have a very strong worker co-op sector. And one of the things that I saw in Spain is that they were teaching about cooperatives and social enterprises more generally in their universities. And so they're disseminating knowledge in a very intentional way. And it sounds like you were exposed to that at some point, but that doesn't probably exist anymore here.
Well, I don't think it does. Well, we've got the dean of the business school coming up after you're on to talk about sustainability, and I'm going to ask him about cooperatives and what they – I don't think they have a course that specifically says cooperatives and how they function, but that it'll be interesting to talk to him about that. Melissa Scanlon, our guest, I hope you'll join in with your questions. We're talking with her about prosperity in the fossil-free economy, cooperatives, and the design of sustainable businesses. You can join us at 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us. The email address is ideas@wpr.org. Natalie Guyette, our producer today, Trina LaSusa, our engineer. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network, taking a look at cooperatives and the design of sustainable businesses. That's the subtitle of Melissa Scanlon's book. It's great to have her with us to talk about the book. I found it really interesting, and I think you will too. You can join in 800-642-1234, or you could email us the email address ideas@wpr.org. You know, when I took that class in cooperatives, Marv Schars would talk about financial and social, and I don't know if it was environmental, if it was stated that way, but that kind of a part of the cooperative philosophy. Maybe we should just explain to people, if they're not familiar with cooperatives, how they function.
Sure. So these are, and we could let you do that, Larry, and see how well you remember that course. But I'll help you out here. So these are enterprises that can be organized for profit or not for profit, and they operate with a purpose based on ethics, values, and principles. They can be found in most sectors of the economy in most countries in the world, but you may not even realize where they are. So there are insurance cooperatives, energy cooperatives, water. They can be owned and operated by workers. They could be organized and owned by farmers or producers, or they could be consumer cooperatives. And basically, they create these platforms for participation for members to join together to reduce the cost of doing any kind of business, really, because people are cooperating with each other. They have been extremely critical to bringing electricity to rural America. The electric co-op came out of the New Deal era.
Yep.
And basically, we're able to work with farmers who organized electric co-ops, and at a time when there had only been about 10% of the households electrified across rural America, we're able to change that entire system and bring power to farmers. So because cooperatives are, I mentioned values, because they're found in so many different countries, there is an international cooperative alliance, and they have defined these cooperative values and principles that individual countries and co-ops incorporate more or less into their operations. And the ones who incorporate them more intentionally and into the legal design of their business are the ones that I have recognized in the book as the real pathbreakers, those who have really organize themselves around these values end up being the ones that stand apart.
And they are ones that are successful businesses.
Right. And there's so many examples in Wisconsin of this. I mean, we have a very rich cooperative sector. You mentioned the course that you took. Well, UW-Madison hosts the Center for Cooperatives, which is a major powerhouse in terms of research on cooperatives, look to nationally. You've got Union Cab in Madison, the Dairyland Power Co-op in Western Wisconsin, just tons of credit unions all throughout the state. And of course, the Green Bay Packers demonstrate the power of community ownership, right? Anyone who understands that the Packers will not be sold to the highest bidder and leave this state knows the power of community ownership.
I hadn't thought about the Packers, but you're absolutely right. Well, I was surprised. I don't know why I was surprised, but you talked about Spain quite a bit. The country of Spain in your book. It was a great story about a professor there who got an electric cooperative. I think it was an electric cooperative, power yeah, cooperative yeah. started. Tell that story.
Yeah. So first, maybe I should say why Spain?
Yeah.
Spain is home to the largest worker-owned cooperative in the world, the Mondragon Cooperative. So people who are really interested in this sector like to go to Spain to study why Mondragon was successful. I went to Spain, but I didn't go to that region. I wanted to understand the next generation of cooperatives, those that were inspired by Mondragon. And those are the ones that demonstrate really how this idea has proliferated across different economies. And we see the stories from the U.S., all of them were inspired by Mondragon. They all mentioned that in their founding. So that's just an aside. But the story you're talking about is a renewable energy cooperative that a professor and a group of students and supporters, about 150 people, started in 2010. And it became Spain's first national renewable energy co-op and has just grown tremendously over the past decade to have over 70,000 members. They're providing just multiple 17 gigawatt hours of renewable electricity throughout the country. And combined with that, they're really focused on democratic engagement of their members. So they have a great example of combining local groups and national organization and using technology to bring people together, but also meeting in person in these smaller groups so that people can share information about how to conserve energy and how to really shrink your electric and carbon footprint. And a lot of that is, I think, inspiring to see. And I think, I hope that it inspires the electric co-op leaders in the U.S. too, to think about how to become these kind of leaders in renewable energy and democratic engagement of their members.
And for them, it's both, it's solar, it's wind.
Yes, wind, hydro.
Yeah, they don't just rely on one thing. They're looking at different types. And it was kind of interesting as to how they set that up with the, you know, the various solar and wind generating systems. A lot of it just local, if I'm not mistaken.
They were able to capitalize it with local member investments. And that provides a really interesting model too, that they weren't going to the banks for loans, but they were going to their members and they were able to finance these major investments in renewables through the power of individual members. And I think that shows the power in numbers, and it shows the ability to create a platform that is easy to join and then becomes this place where people want to be and they want to be interacting and they add their power to it.
I want to give our listeners, more of our listeners, a chance to join in. Let's go to Amy in Milwaukee. Amy, hi. Thank you for calling.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to mention in Milwaukee, we have the Outpost Natural Foods Cooperative, which has been, it's over 50 years old. It started in 1970. It has been the largest consumer cooperative in the Midwest and the Great Lakes region for many years. I'm not sure exactly today if that's the case, but it has been for about 40 years. And is obviously member-owned. There's four locations in Milwaukee. It is a cooperative and an organization that is built on the cooperative principles. Madison, as you're mentioning, Larry, had one of the largest schools. It was started cooperative college, kind of a section, and it was started by one of the Milwaukee Outpost Cooperative members. So I really wanted to mention that. And we have a general manager who's been with the Outpost for many, many years, who is just probably the most magnificent businesswoman and her team in the state, and doesn't get the recognition we need. This cooperative is vital to the Milwaukee region.
Oh, Amy, thank you so much. Melissa, a comment?
Yeah, thanks for sharing that story. I'm a lifetime member of that co-op and, of course, really appreciate it. So I'm glad you shed some light on it.
Yeah, it's a great story. Margie in Milwaukee, we'll go to you. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thanks, Larry. I have a comment and then kind of a serious question. My comment is I went to Purdue University in the 70s, and I pledged a sorority early at the end of freshman year, not knowing what I was doing. And later, I have a lot of friends that were teachers, and they lived in a co-op on campus. And I really wish I would have done that at the time. I think that would have helped me a lot in a lot of my endeavors. So hopefully those are still around on campus, too. My question is, as important as the climate change and the renewable resources and all that are, I'm so frustrated with what's happening with the House and the Senate. And Senator Manchin is the chairman of the Senate Energy and Natural Resource Committee. And he's dragging his feet on all this, and he wants to cut it in half what Biden wants to do. What can we do? So frustrated, because he's from West Virginia, so he doesn't care if I call and complain to him. What can we do to kick these people in the butt and say, you know, he has so many big donors that are from fossil fuel, I don't know if he's ever going to change.
Hmm. Margie, thanks a lot for calling. Melissa, what do you think?
Yeah, you had two things there. I want to, your comment was about housing co-ops, and that is a really important way that co-ops have impacted people's lives and lowered the cost of being able to be a homeowner. And we've seen some real innovations, I think, in land trusts that own the land and reduce the cost for people who are in housing co-ops to live more sustainably. I don't write about that in the book, but I do want to just acknowledge that that's an important part of what co-ops can offer. And then to your other point, you raise a really, I think, a frustration that a lot of people feel about this particular senator who has received the most money from fossil fuel industry and holding the country hostage in this way. I think what you're highlighting really is the important distinction that you can and should take individual actions to be more sustainable, right? But don't just rely on that. There needs to be organizing and political organizing for change on the larger system. And without that larger system-wide change at the political level, we will not be able to address the scale of this problem on the time frame that is needed, that science, that physics tells us is needed. So please do all your individual actions, but what the caller is highlighting is the need for political organizing and being involved.
And some of what you talk about in your book is that there's kind of a way around some of the rules and regulations. I don't mean having to break the rules and regulations, but cooperatives can serve a purpose that resolves many of the issues that we're hearing about today.
Yes. And one of the examples I give in the book is from Cobb EMC. This is an electric co-op that exists in Georgia. So it's a good example because Georgia does not have any state laws that promote renewable energy, doesn't have any kind of climate goals. And yet this private sector entity, Cobb Electric Co-op, has been able to be a major leader in solar power. And on some days produces the most electricity from solar of any Eastern co-op. So sometimes they're producing 40% of their meeting 40% of their electric demands just based on solar. And this was all done without any kind of political will in the state. And it's because of the values of the co-op combined with the fact that it's a nonprofit structure. So it doesn't need to produce any kind of returns for its shareholders. and the lower price of solar. So all that means that the business case is stronger than the political case in that state, right? And so this private sector can still move forward even when politicians might be dragging their feet and not able to move forward in a productive manner.
Yeah. Thanks very much, Margie, for that question. Appreciate it. You can still join in at 800-642-1234. Email to ideas at WPR.org as we move along here with Melissa Scanlon, her book, Prosperity in the Fossil Fuel Economy. Well, let's talk more about why what's wrong with business. And I guess you kind of get at it. The way that we're structured with business in this country is different from what the way cooperatives businesses are structured.
Yeah. So I want to give, I'll give another Wisconsin story that I don't cover in the book, cause I don't want to be, you know, a spoiler. You want people to get the book and learn more, but this really, I think, underscores how businesses that are designed to serve the common good are really important for us. So last year, Verso closed the paper mill in Wisconsin Rapids, right? So This was the largest employer in Wisconsin Rapids. And there's now a push to reopen that mill and the one in Park Falls as the consolidated cooperative. So this would be a cooperative with mill workers, Northwoods loggers, and a variety of industry allies as member owners. And this is really exciting to see. So the point of this, if the cooperative would be successful, is that when there's a downturn in the economy, you don't just close the mill and move to another location where it's cheaper because you're paying workers less and polluting the air and water more. The co-op members are committed to the community. They're not moving. And they're all going to have to work together to respond to the changes in the market, to tighten their belts, to come up with ideas for how to get through those hard times while maintaining the jobs that so many thousands of people around the Wisconsin Rapids area throughout so many different businesses benefited from. So I think that's a really key current event that's happening in the state, and it demonstrates how this idea of community ownership is really catching on. And it's not a Republican Democrat idea. It's about being committed to the community and having businesses that are designed to serve the community in which they're operating.
And you mentioned a broad array of people, different types of people bringing different skills to this one production. And I think you, at one point, you mentioned that as kind of a necessary thing. And we're not, I don't know if it was critical of them, but some cooperatives have been zeroed in on sort of one aspect, maybe a farmer cooperative, for example, some farmer cooperatives, yes, for example.
Yeah. So I think having a hybrid ownership model can help to strengthen a cooperative. And so I was excited to see that present in what the consolidated cooperative is trying to do, to have all these different types of owners. I give an example in the book of a major grocery store chain in Spain that is organized as a cooperative, and they have worker owners and consumer owners, and they produce benefits for both of those classes of owners. And that makes a lot of sense, I think, because many of our food co-ops are organized as consumer co-ops, and the workers sometimes feel like they're not being treated as fairly as maybe they would be if they were also worker owners.
You give a lot of great examples in your book, and that's a really positive part of the positive nature of your book, because it does offer some some good solutions to a lot of these environmental problems and social problems that we are facing right now. As you think about it, if we can, what are the probably the biggest barriers to actually go against your kind of vision of cooperative, sustainable businesses?
Well, I think a major barrier is educational, and your personal story touches on that. So how many business schools are teaching future leaders about cooperatives and sustainability? It will be really interesting for you to talk to the dean of the business school next and ask about this. How many classes are offered to teach these business leaders about how to run a cooperative or any kind of other democratic entity? And in the law school, how many law schools are teaching social enterprise law and educating lawyers about the importance of legal design of the businesses so the lawyers can work hand in hand with business leaders to put these core sustainability purposes into the DNA of the business structure? Without that, it's really hard to change the dominant business structure that's there if your educational system isn't even geared towards providing those kind of examples. So I'm hoping that my book will be able to be used by people teaching about these things, but also that it could be picked up by people who are working to change government policies to prioritize supporting converting existing privately held businesses. We have this huge opportunity with the baby boomers who are going to be retiring to convert those businesses to worker-owned co-ops, to support the emergence of new co-ops. I mean, I wrote the book at a level that I hope makes it accessible to people in all different walks of life so that they can take from it what they need. You said that I have a lot of positive stories, and that was intentional. I think people are motivated by a positive vision for the future, not just by fear or trying to minimize suffering, but trying to create new businesses that actually advance us further in society so that we're sharing prosperity across our all different dimensions.
Yeah. Well, you have an interesting, really exciting book, Melissa. I want to thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. I really appreciate it.
Well, thanks a lot for having me, and I'd love to talk about it anytime with anyone.
Okay, Melissa, we'll take you up on that. Melissa Scanlon, our guest today, she is the author of the book Prosperity in the Fossil-Free Economy, Cooperatives and the Design of Sustainable Businesses, published by Yale Press. So it's great to have her with us. And I will be talking with our next guest, the dean of the UW-Madison Business School, about their efforts to inform sustainability practices into their coursework in the School of Business. So that's coming up next. I hope you'll stay with us. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network.